Hello, I'm Father Ambrose Little, the director of the Thomistic Institute. Before we begin the next great TI lecture, a quick word with you. Thanks to donors like you, our content is cutting through the digital noise with the truth of the Catholic intellectual tradition. But we can't keep it coming without your help. If you enjoy programs like the TI Podcast and Aquinas 101, please consider a small contribution of $25 or more. You can use the link in the description or visit our website to donate. Your generosity ensures that these important programs will continue to lead souls to the truth all over the world. So please enjoy this episode, and may God bless you and keep you in His grace.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
It's an honor to be here to give reflections on the topic of Catholic social teaching, what it is, and why it's so important, and why everybody should actually care about it and learn about it. In this presentation, then, I want to ask two questions. What is Catholic social teaching? Because that's a confusing topic. Everybody has their own kind of pet answer. And then also, second question, why is Catholic social teaching so important for my spiritual life? And my goal is to show that built within the very answer to the first question is also the answer to the second question. We understand what we're talking about. But I also recognize that answering the first question is no easy task. Catholic social teaching means a lot of things to a lot of diverse people. It's kind of turned into just anything that anybody wants it to be. Almost sometimes like a bludgeon for different factions within the church. It's been very confusing. So first, it is Catholic. Second, it is social. This is actually important. And finally, it is a real teaching, or more specifically, theology, which means it's actually real theology. So Catholic social teaching as real theology has God as object. Okay? I see some people taking notes. It has God as object. That's actually very important. I did not, for purposes of this presentation, Hunter asked me earlier if I have a presentation or a kind of a slideshow or anything. I did not. I see people taking notes, which is wonderful. As a student of Catholic social teaching, I understand that power corrupts, and PowerPoint corrupts, absolutely. So I did not, although I could have. I was thinking after he sent me, do you have a PowerPoint? It's like, this could actually lend itself to PowerPoint. I'll take your feedback later, if PowerPoint might actually be helpful. I think it's corrupting. But that's either way, that's another here. First, a summary of what the church colloquially refers to as Catholic social teaching. Simply put, Catholic social teaching is a tradition of theological, moral, and social reflection inaugurated by Pope Leo XIII over 100 years ago with the great encyclical Rerum Novarum of 1891. It's kind of the commencement of this tradition. And as the title of the encyclical suggests, Rerum Novarum, of new things or on new things, Catholic social teaching was a response to the new things thrust onto the Christian West by the emerging industrial revolutions, the financial revolution, and the socialists and Marxist reactions to these revolutions, reactions that had built into them, in many ways, the very reaction and even the contours, the very contours and content of the error that they were trying to correct. That's important. Pope Leo XIII himself did not use the phrase Catholic social teaching. At that point, it was simply Catholic political thought. The phrase Catholic social teaching was a development of Pope Pius XI in the great encyclical commemorating the 40th anniversary of Rerum Novarum, which is Quadragesimo Anno, 1931. But the introduction of the phrase Catholic social teaching and the proliferation of we use this phrase all the time, the newness of this phrase in the 20th century lends us to be tempted to assume that Catholic social teaching is itself something new. This is a mistake. This is a great error. We think that it is a new teaching, distinct, or in many ways different from what the Church had taught before. I would insist not. And to explain why, actually, let me use an illustration that I have used for many of my students. An illustration. When I first entered a Dominican at St. Albert's Priory in Oakland, California, my duty was to be the sacristan of the house. And there's a lot that goes into it. It's kind of complicated. There's a lot of things to know, a lot of things to remember. I had it down to a science. I knew where everything was. I knew what to put out when, what to put away when. I knew everything. But the thing is, at the end of my duty as sacristan, I actually had the additional duty of explaining the sacristan duty to someone else. A new guy that just came in that was going to be the sacristan. And in the process of actually having to explain to someone else what I had been doing for years, I actually realized for the first time all of these little things that I was doing that I didn't even realize I was doing. Little things that I knew were part of the job, but I never articulated them, even to myself, right? Does anybody know the phenomena I'm talking about? When we actually have to explain an enterprise for the first time, oftentimes the very explainer learns it again, anew, in detail. Details that perhaps were left unarticulated now have to be articulated. Catholic social teaching in the 20th century is just precisely such an explanation. It wasn't until the revolutions of the 18th and 19th century that we actually had to explain certain social principles that had never been questioned before. Does that make sense? And then for the first time, the Church has to actually put into articulated words common sense that we always understood. Does that make sense? Let me give you another example of what I'm talking about. When Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the door in the Wittenberg Cathedral in 1517, Europe at that time, or what we now call Europe, was a patchwork of about 500 different flags. There were 500 quasi-independent polities that we call Europe. When Leo XIII was elected Pope in 1878, those 500 units were reduced to about 25. The development of the modern nation state, the Treaty of Westphalia, wars that consolidated immense power that had never been consolidated before. Now, back in the 14th century, we didn't call this patchwork of 500 distinct units. We didn't call it subsidiarity. We didn't call it division of powers. We didn't call it decentralization. We didn't call it anything. It was just what we did. But it had never been questioned. Does that make sense? Is Catholic social teaching something new? Yes and no. It is a new articulation, yes, but is a new articulation of fundamental spiritual and social and anthropological principles that are buried in the Church's classical tradition. Actually, they even predate the Church. It's the classical tradition. And that's what we're going to talk about. Cool? All right. It's a new theological reflection on the principles of society in light of and conditioned by the new situations of modernity. Okay. With this in mind, then, let me articulate first what Catholic social teaching is not. This is going to be important. Catholic social teaching is not simply Catholic politics. It's not a Catholic prescription for state action. That is a radical shrinking or even contradiction of what Catholic social teaching is. It is not the emergence of a new Catholic voice which finally drummed up the courage in the modern world to enter political debates. That's not what it is. The Catholic Church has always influenced politics. The Catholic Church has always been influential in social action. Also, Catholic social teaching is not simply the activistic arm of the Church. Catholic social teaching is not social activism. Like I said, it's theology. It's not simply activism. Okay? That's very important. This is a great deception and can reduce the Church's moral reflections to something far less than it actually is. So what is it? As mentioned already, and I will keep repeating, it is real theology. It has God as its object. It's moral theology, meaning it's a reflection on how the human person, through the human person's authentic human action, actus humanus, authentic human action, moves towards his own perfection as a creature created in the image and likeness of God. Cool? It's a social moral theology. Reflection on how the human person is the type of creature who must come to perfection, reach his end through society. Is everybody with me? All right. So what does it mean to be social? Okay, so the first thing we have to understand. What does it actually mean to be social? As human beings, we are genus and species, we are rational animals. Rational animals. That's the genus and species of who we are. But as rational animals, the ancient philosophers and ancient thinkers also realized that built into our rationality was something else. Something else built into it, and that is relationality. We are not just rational animals, but as rational animals, we are social animals. We are the social animal. In Greek, we are zoon politikon. We are the political animal. Zoon politikon. In the contemporary world, it's easy to misunderstand what this means because of the horrific violence that has been done to the word political. Let's talk about this word political. What does it mean? Let me use an illustration to talk about what has happened to the word political. This is an example from my own life. It was at the beginning of the pandemic that we just experienced, the tragic lockdowns when everybody was stuck in their house. I remember talking on the phone back in late 2020 with a friend of mine who worked at a parish where I was at the time. We're talking, just catching up, and she says, "Oh my gosh, ever since the lockdown, I've gotten so political." And I say, "What?" I said, "Really, what do you mean you've gotten political?" She says, "Oh, well, I mean, I've just been in my house all day. I've been stuck in my house, but I've gotten really political." I was like, "What? You've been stuck in your house all day, you haven't seen anybody, but you say you've gotten really political?" I said, can you describe for me what you mean by getting political?" She goes, "Oh yeah, I'm totally political. I'm just like binge watching 8 hours a day of CNN." So that's what has happened to the word politics. Yelling at pixels on a screen. That's what we think being political means in the modern world. Yelling at pixels on a screen. Guys, I mean, please. You are a social animal. To be political animals means that we are the type of creatures that must exist and inhabit society. Society. In other words, we are creatures who by nature live in a polis. A polis, which is just Greek for city, where we get the word political. We have a polis to which we belong. We have a place. To be a human person, a social creature, means that you have a place to which you have a type of allegiance, a place to which you belong. A place in Greek, a topos, a place. For the ancient thinkers, this was common sense. To not live in society meant that one was more like either an angel or a brute animal, but not a human. Not a human, not a rational animal. This was so much the common sense of the ancient philosophers, I'm thinking particularly Aristotle, Cicero, and the like, that the ancients reasoned that to not live in a polis, to not have one place or a topos or a polis, was actually a type of vice. It was a vice, and it was given a name. Does anybody know the name of this vice, to not have a polis? To be the vice of cosmopolitanism. To be cosmopolitan. The ancients understood this as a vice. What does cosmopolitan mean? It means that the whole cosmos is my polis. To be a citizen of the world. It's a vice for the ancient thinkers. Be a citizen of the world. This means that you have no place because every place is my place. Now, to be a citizen of the world, to be cosmopolitan, is equivalent to having no city at all. It's equivalent to being anti-social. To have no society, no community, no place. This means actually being nowhere, having no topos or place. And the person without a place, the person who is cosmopolitan, who doesn't have their topos, is the person who is utopian, which is also a type of vice for the ancients, to be utopian. It's where we get the word utopia. It comes from no place. So the Greek word utopia doesn't mean good place, like some people assume that it means. In the modern world, it just means like this perfect place. But it's not eutopos, it's utopo, like no place. That's where we get the word utopia. This word utopia was first coined by St. Thomas More in his 1516 book called Utopia. So what does it mean then to be social by nature? It means this: as rational animals, we are social by nature and not by coercion. You're not social because someone else forces you to be social. You're social by nature. You are social by nature and not by contract. Okay? That's important. You're not social by contract. You are social by nature and not merely social by consent. Okay? So the social nature of the human person is something far, far deeper than these, let's say, tools of statecraft. Consensus, coercion, contract, right? We reach fulfillment as rational animals through society. We develop the fullness of virtue through society. We develop the full nature of our human personalities through society. This is the center of the teaching of Pope Pius XI. In his great encyclical, his 1937 encyclical, Divini Redemptoris, I highly recommend that you read it. It's one of my favorites, 1937, Divini Redemptoris. This is a quote from his paragraph 29. I see some people taking notes. It's a little bit longer, but there is so much built into this quote. The sisters are so studious taking notes. It's just great. Quote, God has likewise destined man for civil society according to the dictates of his very nature. In the plan of the Creator, society is a natural means which man can and must use to reach his destined end. Society is for man and not vice versa. This must not be understood in the sense of a liberalistic individualism, which subordinates society to the selfish use of the individual, but only in the sense that by means of an organic union with society and by mutual collaboration, the attainment of earthly happiness is placed within the reach of all. He continues. In a further sense, it is society which affords the opportunities for the development of all the individual and social gifts bestowed on human nature. These natural gifts have a value surpassing the immediate interest of the moment. For in society, they reflect the divine perfection, which would not be true were man to live alone. But on final analysis, the Pope continues, even in this latter function, society is made for man that he may recognize this reflection of God's perfection and refer it to the praise and adoration of the Creator. Only man, the human person, and not society in any form, is endowed with reason and a morally free will. There's a lot there. That's a beautiful quote. Is this distracting? Okay. I'm hearing some kind of feedback, but that's all right. This notion of the human person as a rational animal, as a political animal, has remarkable implications. Many might think that society is simply a collection of individual members of a species that work together for survival. And this is indeed part of what society affords us, survival. But human society is more than a mere collection of individuals, each protecting itself. For instance, a pack of wolves hunting as a group might be a collection of individual wolves. But this wolf pack is not a society. A herd of animals is not a society. A hive of bees might work in synchronization for the development of the hive, but this hive is not a society. Not in the real sense. Okay? Only rational animals, that is, human persons, can enter into society. But here's the big question. Why? Why is only rational, the rational animal capable of society, and why must the rational animal come to perfection in that thing called society? The answer to this lies in a type of love. A type of love of which only the rational creature is capable, and that only the rational creature can enjoy. A type of love that not only thrusts us towards another individual that is enjoyed as good, but even more, a type of love that thrusts us towards a transcendent good that is shared with others and enjoyed with others precisely because it is shared. This type of love is called, does anybody know? Friendship. Friendship love. Friendship love. Aristotle, in his Nicomachean Ethics, spends books on friendship. This is the culmination of the life of virtue. The great consummation of the life of virtue is to be able to have a friend. That's why we grow to be capable of that love called friendship. Let's go into this. Friendship creates society. Friendship is the heart and soul of society, and wherever we have friendship love, we have a type of society. Okay? I'm getting affirmative nods from the sisters. This is just great. This is just great. Friendship love is a love of a shared good. This is important, a shared good. Another word for a shared good, a good that is shareable, is the common good. A common good is a shared good. A common good is not simply any good that is shared. A common good is good precisely because it is shareable. Its goodness lies in its shareability. Let me explain a little bit more. I can share pizza with you guys by dividing it up and handing out pieces. This does not make pizza a common good. Pizza is always an individual good that is divided. The pizza does not need to be shared in order to be enjoyed. I can enjoy the pizza whether or not I share it with you. It means it can't be common. Let me use another example that might be even more difficult. We're all breathing the oxygen in this room right now. In a sense, we're all sharing the oxygen. But is oxygen a common good? No. The oxygen that I'm breathing is precisely not the oxygen that you're breathing. And I can enjoy the oxygen in this room whether or not I share it with you at all. Its goodness does not lie in its shareability. Again, its shareability is accidental to its goodness. Does that make sense? So it's not the type of good that we would call a common good. There is nothing in my use of oxygen or pizza that requires my sharing it. It's like... But the common good, the shared common good at the heart of real friendship, love, is completely distinct from these mere consumable realities. Now, actually, brothers and sisters, this is the heart and soul of real, what we would call consumerism. This is the real pathology of real consumerism. It's to treat everything as my own particular good that I consume. That's just my aside. That's another lecture. A common good, and the common good's shareability, is an indivisible whole into which individuals can enter into and participate together. In other words, the common good's shareability does not divide the good itself. Rather, the common good's shareability is the opposite. It actually unites those people into one who enjoy it. Those who share a common good do not consume this good by dividing it up like a material reality. No. Instead, both enter into this good precisely because it is greater than them. A good that is greater than both of them and can encompass them both together as a good that is shared without diminution. This means that a common good of friendship of any kind cannot be possessed in isolation. It's important. I can't possess the common good in isolation from others. One cannot possess a friendship, a family, a marriage, a city in isolation from others. If one exits a friendship, or tragically, if one exits a marriage, they can't take their portion of the marriage with them and just have their portion of the marriage. No, the only way to enjoy these goods, city, marriage, family, friendship, is not to, the only way to have them is to participate in them. Does that make sense? It's a type of goodness that can only be possessed by being shared. Thus, a common good causes real union. It's the only type of good that can cause union, not mere sameness. This is important. A society is not a collection of everybody that's exactly the same. No, 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 no. Actually, the sameness of everybody in the society is accidental to the common good that's shared. This is actually seen most clearly in the family, the common good, which is the family. Everybody is distinct, but nonetheless, they're all sharing this good, which is the family. And actually, the shareability depends on the distinctness of each of its members. That there's a distinct role, the father, mother, brother, sister. Right? It is precisely this entering into a shared union that causes growth in virtue. This is a condition. It is this shared good that is a social friendship. The common good, then, is just the type of goodness that can cause friendship love and, in turn, can be the cause of society. The common good causes society. It is a common good because it is a common cause. Is everybody with me? I know that got a little abstract. So let's turn the corner now. Okay, Catholic social teaching from Leo XIII on, particularly Pius XI, stressed not just the necessity of society, the necessity of love of a common good, but also the fact that there are three necessary societies. Three necessary societies. As mentioned, Catholic social teaching is not new. It is merely a rearticulation in modern form of truths that were handed down from antiquity on. And in this classical tradition of Catholic social thought, a tradition that expands all the encyclicals from Rerum Novarum up to Santissimus Annus of John Paul II and even into Benedict and on, there are three distinct societies that are necessary for the human person. They're completely distinct, but they're necessary. Pope Pius XI claims this. These three societies are each completely different. Each one's function is irreducible to the other. Yet they are each necessary for full human flourishing and growth towards human perfection. These three necessary societies are, anybody know? The family, the polity, and the church. The church is a society. And this is why, since the advent of Catholic social teaching in the late 19th century, we have papal encyclicals specifically dedicated to these three societies. For the first time, Leo XIII started writing encyclicals dedicated just to the family, which is a whole part of the 20th century, because it's a society. And for the first time, we have magisterial statements on ecclesiology. What is the church? I'm thinking particularly Pius XII's Mystici Corporis Christi, 1951. Beautiful encyclical, because these are the three necessary societies. Let's go back to some encyclicals. In his 1929 encyclical, Divini Ilius Magistri, Pope Pius XI speaks of these three necessary. This is paragraph 11. I highly recommend that you read this encyclical. Divini Ilius Magistri. It's an encyclical on Catholic education. It's on education, but so we don't oftentimes think of this as one of the great social encyclicals, but nonetheless, it is a social encyclical. And he writes this in paragraph 11. Now there are three necessary societies, distinct from one another, and yet harmoniously combined by God, into which man is born. Two, namely the family and civil society, belong to the natural order. And the third, the church, to the supernatural order. He then elaborates by describing in the next paragraph, paragraph 12, describing these societies. This is important. This is paragraph 12. In the first place, the family, instituted directly by God for its particular purpose, the generation and formation of offspring. For this reason, it has priority of nature and therefore of rights over civil society. I'm going to say that again. For this reason, the family has priority of nature and therefore of rights over civil society. Nevertheless, the family is an imperfect society, since it has not in itself all the means for its own complete development, whereas civil society is a perfect society, having in itself all the means for its particular end, which is the temporal well-being of the community. And so in this respect, that is, in view of the common good, it, that is, civil society, has preeminence over the family, which finds it suitable own temporal perfection precisely in civil society. This is an interesting relationship between the family and civil society. Both are necessary, but they're distinct. And third, this is paragraph 13. The third society into which man is born, when through baptism he reaches the divine life of grace, is the church. A society of the supernatural order and of universal extent. We're going to go into this, what he means. Universal extent. A perfect society because it has in itself all the means required for its own end, which is the eternal salvation of mankind. Hence, it is supreme in its own domain. Each one of these societies is based on a distinct mode of friendship. The family is rooted in marital friendship. That is the union of husband and wife. The polity is rooted in political friendship that emerges among those who share a common good, share a common community or a common topos or place. And finally, the church is rooted in friendship with God, divine friendship. And another word for divine friendship is charity. The virtue of charity, St. Thomas defines as friendship with God. That's important. And interestingly, in his very first question on charity, he brings in the word, notion of society, that through charity, God enters into a type of society with man. That's charity. Society. Friendship. Such a beautiful thing. Let us explain then these three societies' similarities and differences. Let's go into more detail. Let's imagine now a type of matrix. This is probably when PowerPoint would have come in handy. Just imagine in your mind a type of matrices, okay? Where you have these three distinct societies, necessary societies on top. You have the family, the polity, and the church. And then on the other axis, let's look at some qualities that these societies have. Their origin, their telos, or their end, their number, their extension, how far they extend, and their duration through time. Cool? The origin of these societies. The origin. From what principle does each society emerge? The family emerges from nature. The family is a natural society, but it emerges from the very biological complementarity between the sexes and the necessity for union of the sexes in procreation. It is a biological reality. The society of the family emerges from our very biology. The structure woven into our biological, psychological, and emotional human nature and human complementarity. Now, the polity also emerges from nature. It's natural. But unlike the family, it does not emerge from our biological nature. It emerges from what? Our rational nature. Its origin is the rational and relational nature of the human person, something we don't share with animals. The church, however, unlike the family and the polity, has no origin in nature at all. It is not a natural institution. The origin of the church is completely supernatural. When our Lord Jesus took on flesh during the incarnation, the great hypostatic union of divine and human natures in the one person of our Lord, the supernatural principle of grace penetrates into human history and places within human history a supernatural principle of charity, divine friendship. Now, all who share in this divine friendship are members of the city of God and the society of the blessed. St. Paul tells us, we are aliens and sojourners. Our citizenship is not of this world, our citizenship is in heaven. When through grace we are made friends with God, it's a completely supernatural society. Cool? Let's go to the second little level here on our matrices. What's the end or the telos of each of these societies? Well, the church is, as we said, a supernatural society. It is sacramental. The end of the church is your blessedness, your sanctification, and your ultimate union with God in the beatific vision. Thus, the church and the church alone has a mark of holiness. It's one of the four marks of the church. She is holy because that's her end, is to make you holy. The polity is a natural society, and its end is distinct. It does not have a supernatural end. Its end is the natural tranquility of order within the temporal realm. It is not a sacramental reality. The human polity cannot give grace. Nope. The state cannot give grace. Nope. The dispensation of grace is the unique monopoly of the supernatural society of the church. That's why she alone bears that mark of holiness. And let us remember, if you guys know your church history, the church has decided that the coronation of a king is not a sacrament. There's still many people today that kind of wish it was a sacrament. But no. But interestingly enough, and I must add this, and this will continue, this theme will continue as we reflect on the nature of these societies. In the fallen world, in a fallen world, in a sinful world, the polity will always try to usurp the mark of holiness. The polity will always want to pretend to be the church. Always. This is why those four marks of the church are so important, because these are the four marks that make this society completely distinct. The state will always try to co-opt the mark of holiness. But the monopoly on grace is given by our Lord Jesus Christ to his church. Cool? Now, the family is unique in this altogether. What's the end of the family? The family is also, as we said, its origin is natural, so it has a natural origin. Yet, unlike the polity, it has been elevated by grace to a sacrament. That's interesting. The family has its origin in nature, yet it is the type of good that, even as St. Paul says, is a type of the church, a magnum mysterium, a great mystery that represents Christ in the church. It has been elevated by grace, by a sacrament, to even be a source of an instrumental source of grace for us. That's the family. Isn't that interesting? So the family is unique. This is why, and it's been so tragic in the 20th century. There's been this move to separate family and marriage ethics from social teaching. These cannot be separated. Catholic social teaching has as its heart the church's teaching on marriage and the family. And the teaching on marriage and the family have to be integrated back into Catholic social teaching, or else we just have it's a radical handicap of Catholic social teaching. Cool? That's another one of my little editorial comments. Got it? Let's go to this next little element on our matrices. The number of these societies. How many societies are there? This is important. Well, there are three societies. You're right, sister. There are three societies. But let's go a little bit, you're right, but let's go deeper. Within each, how many are there of each? Okay? How many families are there in the world? A lot. There's a plurality of families. There's at least three, yeah. There's more than three families. So within families, there can be potentially no limit to the amount of families that can be on planet Earth, right? The family is not one. The family is many. There are a plurality of families. How many polities are there? Many. There's more than three. Theoretically, there's no limit to how many polities there can be. Every time there's a people that has a shared common place and custom, there's a polity you can emerge. And there's theoretically no limit to this. How many churches are there? There's one. Ooh, and we're getting somewhere. This is another mark of the church as a unique mark or feature of that unique supernatural society founded by our Lord Jesus Christ. There is only one church and there can be no other. She resists a plurality. Right? One of her marks is this oneness. And I must add, because of this oneness, only the church is cosmopolitan. Only the church is cosmopolitan. The polity cannot be cosmopolitan. Only the church is cosmo. Only the church is global. Because she's supernatural. Because the principle that holds her together, the very glue, is not a natural principle. It's a supernatural principle that transcends all natural borders or division. Only the church, through the supernatural principle of grace, can extend all throughout the world and encompass all peoples. Since the principle of grace transcends nature, only the church can encompass all peoples without destroying their own individual cultures, languages, races. Keep in mind, at the end of the book of Revelation, the very end of the Bible, what comes down from heaven? The holy city. The city is the end of the scriptures. The holy city, Jerusalem. Heaven is described as a society, as a city, where what? All the nations stream towards her. Isn't that beautiful? So this Catholic social teaching actually touches upon some deep theology of what's going on, right? And also, just like the mark of holiness, in the fallen world, it is always the fallen polity that wants to usurp the mark of oneness. Always. It's a feature of our fallen nature. We always want to turn the polity into something like the church. And when I say, this is important, another reason I'll say it here now, I'll bring it up later, why I specifically follow the classical tradition of social thought and use the word polity as opposed to another word that floats around there. Another word that's a substitution for polity oftentimes. What do you think that word is? The state. The state. The polity is something distinct from the state. The state is just the material apparatus that a polity uses to govern itself. But that's not the polity. The state, so the state is a distinct reality. And in the fallen world, the state will always want to usurp these marks. Cool? Let's go to the next one. The extension of these societies. What about the extension? How far can these bonds of friendship within each distinct society actually extend? This is important. The bonds of kinship within a family are the strongest bonds we have on earth. They are absolutely the strongest natural bonds that we have. The blood bonds uniting family members are built into our very biology. The strongest connections that we have. Yet in spite of their strength, and perhaps because of the intensity of the strength of family bonds, their power to extend is actually quite limited. They extend to a rather limited range of people. For instance, the family can have 4, 8, maybe even 12 children, but at a certain point, mother and father cannot have infinite children. Maybe you can extend kind of into the double digits a little bit, but not that much. The family bonds are the strongest. They are the strongest, but because they're strong, their range of extension is limited. We have the reality of extended families. Extended families are a reality, but even these realities, I have a large extended family, so I can say from my own experience, as the extended family extends to cousins, second cousins, third cousins, fourth cousins, the bonds of unity decrease very quickly. They just do. In a sense, I consider the family bonds to be, this is a metaphor that I use, the family bonds are kind of like the nuclear strong force inside. They're like the strongest force we have. They're the strongest thing, but they extend to a very limited range. And because they are so strong, once that union is broken, if the family is broken, that force can create tremendous destruction in society. Because they're so strong. Cool? That's the family. What about the polity? The polity's extent is wider than the family. Since it is rooted in our rational nature, instead of merely our biological nature, it can extend to hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, right? But even here, its extent is still limited. It can extend to tens of thousands, but it can't be infinite. It can't be infinite. It is not, like the church, cosmopolitan. And this is also why, through time, the polity will not really exist in heaven. We'll talk about this later, too. But the church, however, being built on the supernatural friendship with God, can indeed extend to a limitless number of people. And her temporal extension also has no limit. So she can extend throughout space, and the church also extends through time. Thus, only one society, that is the church, possesses the mark of universality or Catholicity. It's a unique mark of the church. Often, until I really started to study the theology of Catholic social thought, I never really got the real depth of like why the marks of the church. We say it in the creed, these four marks, one holy, Catholic, and apostolic. But it wasn't until I really understood social theology that I realized the importance of these four marks, that they distinguish this society from all others. Cool? Only the church is universal. This is why only she is also apostolic, in the sense that she's called to go out to the whole world, making disciples of all nations. She is uniquely called to extend her reach to every corner of the world. And again, let me double back. In a fallen world, the human state will always want to usurp this mark of Catholicity and extend to all corners of the world its influence. Let's go to the duration. The duration, this is the last one on this, the duration of these. Now let's examine not the society's extension through space, but specifically these societies' extension through time. What is the duration of these societies? Will the polity exist in heaven? In heaven, will we be Americans, Canadians, Mexicans, Germans? Well, not really. Not really. In heaven, we will be citizens of the heavenly Jerusalem depicted in Revelation. We will be, and like St. Paul says, by virtue of our baptism, we are members of the household of God and citizens of heaven. Our citizenship, he says, is in heaven. Right? Our natural and earthly nationalities will pass away into that perfect citizenship in the society of the blessed. Will the family exist in heaven? What do you guys think? No, it won't. It won't. And what did you say? Did you say yes? That's all right. I forgive you. It's all about forgiveness. It's all about forgiveness. All right. No. The family's extent through time, then, is also limited. It's not eternal. The family will not exist in heaven. Now, keep in mind, this was actually a question that our Lord himself had to answer. Whose wife will she be in heaven? And Jesus says, you know not the scriptures. Why? In heaven, they will neither marry nor be given in marriage, but will be like the angels. Even though the family is brought into the sacred order by being elevated into a sacrament, the sacrament is given as an instrumental source of grace here and now. There will be no sacraments in heaven. The sacraments are for us here and now, on the way, in via. We will need no sign of the heavenly reality once we have reached the heavenly reality. Now remember what Pius XI says about these first two societies, the polity and the family, is they are natural. They are natural. They only have a natural extent and a natural telos. Now, the whole purpose of these societies is to get you to heaven. It's the ultimate telos, even if the two natural societies have approximate end. We need natural societies to learn to love a transcendent good, the common good, above ourselves. And when we learn to love a transcendent good, that good can be a good that can be shared by many, only then can we be fit to love the God who is shareable by all. Right? These are necessary societies. I've been talking a long time, I'm sorry. I'm going to wrap this up. This is now the conclusion. This is the conclusion. Now we are in a position to answer the second and final question, which we started the presentation. Why is Catholic social teaching important for us? I think that should be kind of self-evident now, why it's actually important. Recall that I mentioned that the answer to the second question is built into the first. What's the opposite notion of the person as a social animal? The opposite notion is this. The opposite image of the human person would conceive of the human person as entering the world, not within society and for society, but entering the world as some type of hyperbolic individual in a state of nature. A state of nature. Virtually all modern political thought begins with this thought experiment about the human person in a state of nature. That in a state of nature, each isolated individual discovers that he has these rights and then enters into political society in order to defend those rights from others. It's fundamentally an antisocial outlook, right? This is not Catholic social teaching. You are a political animal. This means you are the creature that becomes a saint by living in and by loving society. Different societies. Your participation in a type of goodness greater than yourself is the heart and soul of your growth into sainthood. Only your participation in a good greater than yourself, which is a common good, can elicit from your soul a type of self-sacrificial love that mirrors the very love of our Lord Jesus. Only this self-sacrificial love can free you from the burden of isolating selfishness. And most of all, only this self-sacrificial love, possible only in society, can free you from loneliness. The burden of loneliness. It is not good for man to be alone. The very beginning of the scriptures. Only this type of love can free you from that. Also, society is not the material apparatus of the state. This is important. This is really important. Society is much more. Your nature as a political animal does not mean that you sit around and wait for the political apparatus of the state to give you consumable goods. That's not what it means to be a social creature. That's not it. The state is there to protect the common good, to serve the common good, but it is not the source of the common good, nor does it create the common good. Nor, least, can it dole out consumable pieces of the common good as some type of pizza. It's not what it is. You are the social creature. You are the social creature, not the state. You are the primary protagonist of the common good. You are. You are meant to be a giver of goodness, not a mere consumer of stuff, no matter where you get it from. This means that as a political animal, you also have responsibilities and duties. Your duties to society are precisely yours, and they cannot be expropriated to another, to either a bureaucracy, a team of econometricians, a central authority, a planner, or the state. Your duty and your role as a social creature cannot be expropriated to the state. Social justice, care for the poor, the universal destination of goods, all features of Catholic social teaching are your responsibilities that cannot be simply expropriated. The protagonist of friendship as the soul of society belongs to you. If you live your vocation as a political animal, as a social creature, you will grow in holiness. If you live your call, the call of Catholic social teaching, to be a social creature, a political animal, you will grow in happiness. If you live the call of Catholic social teaching to be the social animal, you will be happy. The growth in happiness. and with that, that's why it's important. And that will be, thank you, this is the very end of my talk. God bless you guys. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.